podcast this week, we have more Evil Dead chums and you can shake a boomstick at. There is Alyssa Sutherland, the star of Evil Dead Rise, and the legendary Sam Raimi, the guy who started it all back in 1981 with The Evil Dead, and then Evil Dead 2, and then Army of Darkness. All that and more on the movie podcast that lost its blue tick on Twitter this week, but got nominated for an award. Hooray!
Hurrah!
Hooray, hooray, hooray. We didn't get nominated for an award for losing our blue tick, by the way, because everybody lost a blue tick.
We were in good company. Good at
it. We lost it with grace and panache. And no little dignity either as well. I only cried for a solid 45 minutes. Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt and welcome to the Empire Podcast. This week we're recording it remotely on Friday morning, which means I've got to turn it around very, very quickly. Why do I do this to myself? I do this to myself because I have the lurgy, as you can probably hear. And so we decided not to be in the same room together. And then the aircon went in our studio. So we definitely decided not to be in the same room together, lest we melt. So here we are on Squadcast, joined by my two colleagues of such a lethal cunning, both of whom are completely nude. Great big fucking nerd, James Dyer.
Hello.
And geek queen, Helen O'Hara.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm all right. I'm determined to ignore the blue tick either way, I'll be honest. So you're messing with my plan here.
Shall we move on and tackle this week's listener question, folks?
Oh, yes.
This comes from Lucy Heseltine, Lucy J. Heseltine on Twitter. And she says, we're expecting our first baby in August.
Aw.
That's nice. Congratulations. What are the best film character names that we should consider?
Tyler Rake.
Tyler Rake.
I think that's the answer. I think it has to be like the ridiculous action hero names. You know, incredibly boring first name followed by ridiculous surname. John Wick. Johnny Utah.
Jonathan.
Jonathan is the correct answer.
Jonathan's a great show.
Yeah, I think we've ruined this question already. Just Jonathan is the best one, isn't it?
Jonathan is great. I remember actually when I watched Stardust for the first time thinking to myself, you know, Septimus is a lovely name. maybe Septimus.
Septimus?
Septimus, yeah. It's Mark Strong.
Oh, yes, of course, of course. I always had a problem in, you probably just want to name kids after Mark Strong, all Mark Strong characters.
I mean, including that's pretty true, yeah.
His character in The Brothers Grimsby.
No, not that
no?
one.
No, you sure?
Not that one. Very sure. 100% positive. So what was the question asker's name? Were they like a Smith?
Lucy Heseltine. Heseltine as in Michael Heseltine.
Okay. So we're thinking like John Wick Heseltine maybe, or
yeah, John Wick Heseltine or Tyler Rake Heseltine or Keith Dildo Heseltine or
Michael
Septimus
maybe.
Michael Heseltine.
Yeah. Myers Heseltine.
Michael Myers Heseltine. You got to go full name. You got to go full name. We'll get into Star Wars and the MCU in a second. But there is, of course, you know, you know, here's a great one. Here's a great one. Maximus Decimus Meridius, commander of the armies of the North, general of the Felix Legions, and loyal servant to the true emperor Marcus Aurelius, father to a murdered son, husband to a murdered wife, and I will have my vengeance in this life or the next. Heseltine.
I feel like it's a bit of a downer.
I mean, assembly would take ages, wouldn't it? Like, roll call would just take ages. Maximus? No response. Maximus? No response. Teacher goes, oh, God. Maximus Decimus Meridius, commander of the armies of the North, General Felix Legions, and royal servant of the true Emperor Marcus Aurelius, father to murdered son, husband to murdered wife, and I will have my vengeance in this life or the next.
Present.
Here, fuck's sake.
Yeah, you've got Daenerys Targaryen problems there. I feel also you'd have a nightmare in Starbucks every time you ordered a drink. Just like, and honestly, there's just not enough room on the cup.
Yeah, that's why you have to get a grande every single time.
It'd be a venti.
Is it a venti?
I happen to know that somebody in this podcast once talked about how they'd like to have a child and call them Agamemnon.
It's a perfectly legitimate name, Helen. I stand by this.
Imagine if you're playing at home going, gee, I wonder who it is. I wonder who wanted to call their kid Agamemnon. Is it Chris or James? Chris or James? Chris or James?
He has gravitas.
Obviously, the cards fell in a slightly different way from myself and my wife, and we haven't had kids of our own. But if we had, you know, I had plans. I had plans. You know, I would never have got away with Chewbacca. But I would have tried my damnedest to smuggle Chewbacca in there somewhere. Maybe as a middle name, I have a terrible middle name. So perhaps, perhaps one of our kids could have had Chewbacca as a middle name.
You'd have to go with like Chewitel or something and then just shortened it to Chewie. Well, that's probably the closest you'd have got.
Problem with that though, Jimbo, was then it would be Chewie Hewitt. And
like it's a bad thing.
Well, I was blighted with the nickname Chewit by unimaginative pricks at school. So I don't think I would have really, really gone for that one. But Chewbacca would have been
sweets.
In there somewhere.
They're very nice sweets.
They're lovely, lovely sweets. Tato. That's a great name for a kid.
Boy or girl. It works for either.
Yeah. But I genuinely, there was a point in my life where I was thinking, all right, if I ever have kids, Anfield, obviously. Carlito. Carlito.
No way.
Yeah. Carlito. I was thinking at one point, Raimi.
Raimi is a cute name for a girl, actually.
As a name, yeah. There you go. But, obviously, in deference to my favorite director of all time, my beloved Pathetic Good Boy. Jimbo, any more? Any more members of the cast of Troy?
I mean, all of them, really.
Paris?
Yeah. I mean, let's go north. Thor's quite a good name.
Mm. Yeah. I know a Ragnar.
Yes, you do. Ragnar's a great name.
A Ragnar.
Has he been bathed in the living waters underneath the Civic Center on Mandalore?
I'm going to say yes, but I don't know for sure.
Does the Armorer have a canonical name? Or is it
yes,
just...
it's Armorer, first name, the.
Yeah, okay, fine.
It's Sally.
So I wouldn't use that one.
Sally Forth. That's her name.
Pete.
Tongs. Pete Tongs. It's all gone Pete Tongs for The Mandalorian this week. All right, let's talk about Star Wars. Would you consider any Star Wars names apart from obviously Chewbacca?
Look, if you have fraternal twins and they're a boy and a girl, how are you not going for Luke and Leia? Like, I don't, the option is right there. Like, how are you resisting that option?
I think it creates unrealistic expectations.
I mean, apparently not, because he ended up fucking off to an island and just like milking cows for like years.
That is true.
And she was like a super bad mother who didn't do that good a job, it seems, with the New Republic. I don't know. I feel like that's okay.
Would you take a leaf out of Rey's book and just appropriate the name Skywalker? Because apparently that's just fair game. So would you go Skywalker? Skywalker Heseltine, for example, would be a great name.
That would be okay. I often said that, I don't believe in women changing their name when they get married. I think it's ridiculous and outdated and not even that traditional anyway. It only goes back about 150 years. But the one exception I would make would be if you did fall in love with a Skywalker or something, you would have to think about it. They'd be like, oh, that's pretty cool.
I'd call a child Anakin, just so when they're running around, you go, Anakin! Anakin! Drop!
I mean, if we're talking about expectations placed on a child, that would seem to be much worse.
Possibly,
than Luke and Leia.
But also, if they were playing outside and you looked at the clouds and you saw some inclement weather coming in, you could go, storm's coming up, Annie! Better get home quick!
You could do that. That's
true. You could do that. Yeah.
Fantastic.
Mm. Yeah.
How about something, Cade Bane or something, something.
Cad Bane, is it not Cad Bane?
Oh, yeah. Helen.
I don't care about him. This is what you have to remember. So
that is fair.
That's because he's a cad.
Cad Bane Heseltine, just to bring it back to Lucy for a minute.
Yes. Cad Bane Heseltine. Yeah, I'm not so sure about that. What about the MCU? Any great names bouncing around the MCU? Would you call your kid Groot? Groot Heseltine.
I mean, it trips off the tongue, certainly.
Ronan the Heseltine. More people should have that in their names. They should have the as a middle name.
I did tell you guys that I got a press release from a publicist called Thanos, right?
You did.
I don't know if it's a Scandinavian name or quite
it's
where it came
Greek,
from.
I think.
Is it
Greek? I believe, yeah.
Thanos. So I was like, oh, that press release was inevitable.
You're going to get this, aren't you? You're going to get this thing where names fall out of fashion as they become less and less popular. And maybe they're not popularized in movies. I had a very fun chat with Sam Neill recently for a future issue of Empire magazine. And we talked about how his name isn't Sam, it's Nigel. And he hates the name Nigel, hates it with a passion. And he is delighted to see that it's actually fallen out of favor so much so that I think less than five people in the last roundup they did of kids' names, less than five people in the whole of Britain called their kid Nigel.
It's interesting. I do find it fascinating that the styles of names. I know a couple of kids called Ezra, and I feel like there's been a sort of resurgence of like those kind of 19th century sort of names coming back.
Elspeth.
And I feel like Ethels and Doras and those kind of names are coming back as well.
Ethel. Is Ethel coming back?
I think those, that era at least. I'm not sure Ethel in particular.
What about Ethelred?
That would be cool. I actually think if you're going to go Anglo-Saxon, like, I mean, James is about to say Uhtred any
Uhtred.
Second.
Uhtred of Bebbanburg.
You know, that's, I feel like going kind of a bit medieval on this job is not a bad option. I quite like the medieval classical options. I think they're fun.
I just think, like, if you watch a lot of those, you know, if we're talking Saxons, if we're talking Last Kingdom, if we're going to go back to sort of Viking shows, I just think, like, the old Norse names are the best. Like, if they say, oh, what's your name? Bob, what's your name? Sigurd Bloodhair. Like, there's just something inherently impressive, I think, about that.
But you could be Bob Bloodhair, you know.
You could Bob Bloodhair, yes.
What about Hans? Booby. What about Hans? Would you go for Hans?
No.
So that's a no on Hans, then. What about Gruber? Would you go for Gruber?
As a girl's name or a boy's name?
Just anything. I think Gruber is one of those names. It could be anything, right?
I think I'd prefer it were nothing, but I guess, sure, yeah.
Nakatomi?
That's a lovely name.
Canute.
No. You know how that's going to go in the playground, and it's not going to be fun.
Oi, massive Canute, come over here.
Yeah.
That's a best case.
Beskar.
Beskar Heseltine.
Beskar Heseltine, Beskar Dyer. Yeah, I'm all for that. I'm all for that. Who's your favorite movie character of all time? Right? Okay, so mine's Ash from Evil Dead. So Ash, that's fine. Ash Hewitt, Ash O'Hara, Ash Dyer, Ash Heseltine. That's a good name. Solid name. Could be unisex name as well.
I quite like Hildy, as in Hildy Johnson in His Girl Friday.
Is that your favorite movie character of all time?
She's up there. She's pretty fantastic. There. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, otherwise, like Wesley from The Princess Bride, Buttercup, Inigo. Inigo would be a good name.
What's that from? Oh, from Princess
also
Bride.
Also, The Princess Bride. Yeah.
What about Dr. Peyton Westlake?
Dr. Peyton Westlake Heseltine.
Yes.
Kenneth Noisewater.
Yes, the Octagon. Oh,
no. Proxima Midnight.
That's great. I think we've done it.
Ebony Maw. Yeah.
Among his many skills, I'm saying Thanos had naming down. He was on point.
Yeah, he was. He was. He absolutely was. Ebony Maw, Proxima Midnight, and the other two.
Yeah.
Yeah, brilliant.
Cull Obsidian. And then the little rat man that nobody remembers.
Hang on. Proxima Midnight.
He's the one who looks like a goblin. Corvus Glaive.
Corvus Glaive.
Glaiver.
Bringing it back to ancient Rome here, you know, I'm just saying.
That's the thing, right? Okay, so here's, I'm going to throw one more before we make me make a definitive pronouncement on this. There is Blade. Blade is available. Blade is out there. Blade is open. But as is his real name, which as we all know, is Eric.
True.
Would you call your kid Eric?
I think Blade or Proxima Midnight is the choice.
But then could you not go fancy and just take a name like Eric and just be like, it's Eric, and just drop in an apostrophe like they did with Alan in Wheel of Time?
There's nothing wrong with an apostrophe.
And then you can just go Eric.
Or a silent Q. That's always fun. Okay, we're talking about first names here, all right? But we haven't explored code names and code numbers to come after the surname. So what if it was just like a simple name, like Gary, right?
Yeah.
Gary Heseltine, right? But what if it was Gary Heseltine 007? And what if you went the whole hog and actually went Ian Fleming's Gary Heseltine 007?
Okay,
and then what if you went the whole hog and went, what's your name? My name is Daniel Craig as Ian Fleming's Gary Heseltine 007. And then what if you went the whole hog and went, my name is Daniel Craig as Ian Fleming's Gary Heseltine 007 in No Time to Die?
I feel like it's quite complicated.
Yeah,
I think
you're running out of boxes on the on the forms that you have to fill in.
I think if you want to go designations, the Borg have this on point. So it would be Gary Heseltine's tertiary adjunct of Unimatrix 01 or something like that. Gary 7 of 9.
Yeah.
I think that would work for me.
I think Helen is right. If it's a girl, Proxima Midnight Heseltine. Right?
Yeah.
If it's a boy...
That sounds like a bedtime, though, doesn't it?
If it's a boy, Jarnathan!
Fair.
Jarnathan Heseltine, but you have to say it like that every single time. that is less unwieldy than Maximus Decimus Meridius, commander of the armies for the North, general of the Felix Legions, and loyal servant to the true Emperor Marcus Aurelius, father to a murdered son, husband to a murdered wife, and I will have my vengeance in this life or the next. If you want to have your question read out in the Emperor podcast, we may be stripped of our blue ticks, but you can still slide into my DMs. No nudes. And you can send me a question that way, or you can reply to any of my tweets. If you can see them, of course, that is. You may not be able to see them anymore because of the algorithm. Yeah. Deploy algorithm. Or you can wait for a panicked shout out every now and again. Shall we have a guest?
Yeah.
Why not?
Let's have a guest from Evil Dead Rise, shall we? Rise. James, you disappoint me that you didn't do it.
Rise. There you go. Today. That's sorry.
Better. Yeah. It's early morning, in fairness.
Vocal fry, that's called. When you do that with your voice.
That's a great name for a kid.
It is, isn't it?
Vocal fry. Stephen's kid. Right. So, who do you want? Do you want Alyssa Sutherland, the star of Evil Dead Rise, or do you want the man himself, my beloved possessive goat boy, Sam? Who do you
Let's start with Alyssa.
Let's start with Alyssa Sutherland. So, Evil Dead Rise, in case you don't know what it is, it's the fifth Evil Dead movie, and it is written and directed by Lee Cronin, and it is absolutely fantastic. Spoiler alert for the review section later on. It is brilliant. It is my second favorite Evil Dead movie, folks, and praise doesn't come much higher than that. And it stars Alyssa Sutherland and Lily Sullivan as two sisters who find themselves besieged by deadites in their LA apartment building. And, you know, it's been fairly out there in the marketing that Alyssa Sutherland's character, Ellie, who is the mother of three kids, is possessed by the evil, and in a very, very truly terrifying way, she becomes the main deadite that plagues the rest of the family throughout this very gnarly, very gory, very fucked up horror movie. Alyssa Sutherland, of course, James, you will have known her from Vikings.
Indeed.
Where she played...
someone? Who did she play? Tell me the name of the character and I'll know who it is.
Well, yes, that's how names work, you see, James.
while we're back on names, I have to say, like when we were looking up the names of Thanos' children, I have found out that both Gamora and Nebula have first names. It is Zehoberai Gamora and Lufamoid Nebula. This is absolutely true.
Lufa!
Lufa!
Oh, well, this changes everything.
Lufamoid!
No wonder they're so angry.
That is. That's the reason.
Oh, my God. I'd be furious if my name was... what the fuck was it?
Zehoberai Gamora and Lufamoid Nebula.
Jesus,
it feels like the kind
Christ.
Of name that Phoebe might have changed her name to in Friends.
Yes. By the way, Regina Phalange is an amazing name.
That's
Princess
true.
Consuela Banana Hammock is also a good name.
Crapbag is also a good name.
Alyssa Sutherland was Queen Aslaug.
Oh, Aslaug, yes. She supplanted Lagatha by the side of Ragnar Lothbrok on the throne of Kattegat.
And they were allied with Jonathan?
They were allied with Jonathan, yes. Jonathan!
See, this is why I did this interview and not James. Otherwise,
because I'd have just listed off all the Viking names, it's true. Yeah.
Anyway, Alyssa Sutherland, I had a blast talking to her. She is Australian. She's from Brisbane. Brisbane? No one ever says that. She's from Brisbane. She's from Brisbane in Australia. And she's terrific in this film. Really, really, really terrifying and truly scary. Thankfully, she was neither of those things when I talked to her last night on Zoom. So here is that interview. Do please enjoy. We are delighted to be joined on the Emperor podcast by the star of Evil Dead Rise, Alyssa Sutherland. How are you?
Hey, Chris. I'm good. How are you?
I'm not too bad. Not too bad at all. It is so weird. After I've seen this film a number of times. It is so weird to hear your real accent.
Do you know, I've never actually worked in my natural accent. I've never been Australian for a character.
Would that be difficult to do, do you think, or would it come naturally? Would you almost think yourself out of the accent?
I would love to do it. No, I would love to do it. There's always like a feeling like you're in a character when you have an accent, but to be able to just let loose fully kind of as myself would be great. Yeah.
I don't know. I think if you said the line, "Mommy's with the maggots now," with your real accent, I'd feel reassured and calm. Everything is going to be all right.
Really?
Yeah, I think so.
I should probably do it thicker. Mommy's with the maggots now.
less reassured than I think.
Yeah, that's just weird.
That time it was pure terror, I have to say. But yes, congratulations on the film. I mean, you must be, it opens this weekend. It's been a fairly long journey to get here, but people are raving about the film, and rightly so. So you must be fairly excited about what's about to unfurl.
Yeah, I am. I'm pretty chuffed. I'm not going to lie. It's a definite bucket list moment. You know, this career is a tough one. There are high highs. There are low lows. And I know right now I'm riding one of the highs. So I'm just soaking it up and super grateful. And yeah, pinch me, you know.
What does that mean for you from your point of view personally? Are you taking more meetings? Is it having that sort of impact on things or?
Yeah, it's interesting. It's very interesting. There's certainly bigger interest. And I temper it, you know, because I've also really struggled and had people not interested. And I know that a lot of it, it's great to be in projects that have success and people want to know that you can carry a film. But at the same time, I feel like I've been around. I feel confident in my talent. I know that not every role is right for me, but I don't think I've changed all that much as an actress in the last like however long. I think once I was wrapped on Vikings, I learned a lot on, and I think I really sort of grew and found confidence as an actress on set on Vikings, and just like more than anything else, learned to trust myself. So I feel like the added interest is like, it's kind of like high school sometimes, and you feel like, okay, you like me now because this thing happened. And I don't know. I'm always afraid of having high expectations because it can be a long way to fall. We'll see. I would love for this to really lead to other bigger things and ride that wave.
Absolutely. I hope that happens as well, because you are, not to put too fine a point on it, terrifying in this film, which is, I mean, the physicality. I really wanted to talk about the physicality you bring to Ellie. Spoiler alert for anyone who hasn't seen Evil Dead Rise. Ellie undergoes something of a transformation, shall we say. And once that happens,
yeah,
there's a little aspect of, you can see the real Ellie beginning to, trying to peek through. But there's also a moment, and again, I don't want to give too much away, where that is completely extinguished. And what we're seeing is Evil Dead Ellie, as Dead-Eyed Ellie. And yeah, everything changes about your performance from that point on. How much work, how much prep did you go into that and go into the physicality, the way she moves her body, the way she moves her feet even changes completely?
Yeah, I did a lot of prep. I went all over the place with it. I was very excited that Lee was interested in me for the role, because I just don't think we see characters like Ellie on screen that much at all. And I would like to think that she's sort of breaking new ground for how psychotic women can be on film. I love that she's fully unhinged and deranged. And it was so much fun to play as an actress. And I really wanted to do that. And when the role came my way, I wanted to squeeze all the juice out of it that I could. So I worked really hard and did a lot of prep. I watched a lot of films to watch sort of classic villains and monsters, not necessarily just from the horror genre, but those iconic performances, mostly because I didn't want to subconsciously recreate something that I'd already seen, because I think that can filter into your psyche. I watched some weird things and references. It's out there now that I used Jim Carrey in The Mask as some inspiration.
I'd rather that than Jim Carrey in Ace Ventura.
Yeah. I can see where you're coming from.
Or Ace Ventura When Nature Calls, when he has to crawl out of the back of a fake rhino. Nobody wants that.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. That would have been, yeah, not super appropriate.
It might work in an Evil Dead movie. I don't know.
You know what? That's one of the things I love about Evil Dead, is that you never know what you're going to get. I mean, Army of Darkness, you know, it could go any which way.
It's a hell of a thing. I mean, I read an interview with you where you said that, you know, pretty much every day you were going to work going, okay, what am I doing today? What's happening today? What hellish things am I going to, you know, to do today?
And yeah,
that obviously applies in terms of the things that Ellie does, but you know, these roles, when you're possessed, you get to say some pretty choice lines of dialogue as well.
Which
must be an interesting thing to get your teeth into.
Yeah, it's really fun for me specifically because I'm really quite buttoned up as a human. I'm extremely respectful of people around me. I never ever want to say anything that's even mildly abusive to someone. So it's a very different end of the spectrum for me to be playing in, and so much fun because I don't get that in real life, and rightly so. I don't think we should be saying things like that to people in real life, but to be able to play in that playground and it in a sense be like a safe space to be saying things like that because we all know it's pretend. It was great. It was so much fun and very liberating. I discovered I have a lot of unexpressed rage. I've definitely been a people pleaser in my life and have sacrificed myself to keep other people comfortable. And that doesn't just roll off your back. Those feelings kind of get squashed down somewhere, I think, when you've lived like that. And so I had a lot to tap into. And I would think that there are probably a lot of women out there that can relate to that.
Was that an unexpected side effect of this role, that you got to delve deep into yourself and actually got to confront those parts of yourself that you didn't even know existed?
Oh, I think I knew they were there.
Oh, you knew they were there. Okay.
Yeah, I think I knew they were there. I'm fairly self-aware as a human. I knew what I could tap into, but it was it did end up being like quite therapeutic. It's almost like, it's how I imagine those rooms that you can go into with a baseball bat and just like hit things and demolish stuff. It felt a little bit like that. I had a dream in character as Ellie, and I killed someone with my bare hands. And I sort of woke up from it and went, well, that was interesting. Just someone from my past. And it was actually very therapeutic. Because you don't do that in real life.
Is that someone that you would want to kill in real life, or was this somebody that you don't want to kill?
No, not at all. Let me be very real. I don't ever want to kill anyone. I see it more as a metaphorical, like, you don't need to be here anymore in my head, in my brain space. You can leave now. I think I'm more like that.
Wow. Blimey, this is all stuff I bet you didn't think would happen when you took this role on.
I did not think I would have dreams like that, but I often do. I often dream in character when I'm on a job. I didn't quite think that part of it through when I took on the role of Ellie. Yeah.
Is that something that started right away when you started acting, or is that something that's developed over the years?
Yeah, it started from Vikings. I would have dreams as Alslog, for sure.
Wow. I'm fascinated by that.
It doesn't like affect me though. It doesn't stay with me. Sometimes it gives me more insight into the character. Like, I'm not mad about it.
That's incredible. All I dream about is hotels filled with snakes. Is that, I don't know, should we analyze that?
So do I, mate. Yeah, I dream about snakes as well. It's no good.
Well, you're Australian. It comes to the territory.
Exactly. And they will really kill you there as well. If you get bitten by a snake in Australia, like, good luck. Get yourself to a hospital quick, smart.
Yeah. 10 deadliest land snakes in the world all live in Australia.
Do they though? Because there's the black mamba in Africa, but we should probably save that for another conversation because I go deep with snakes. I like to know what I'm dealing with.
I saw a documentary once that said the 10 deadliest land snakes all live in Australia. But how true that, I don't know. It might have been a Steve Irwin thing. Who knows? Okay, let's do that. 10 of the top 12, and then the black mamba gets extra points.
You know what? We're both probably wrong on this, and people are going to write in.
There's some snake experts at home going, what the fuck are they talking about? This is outrageous. Yeah. I tuned in for an Evil Dead conversation. They're talking about snakes, and they're not even getting it right.
Yeah.
Snakes and dreams. What is this? Unbelievable. Unbelievable. But anyway, so let's get back to Evil Dead Rise.
Yeah,
and obviously films aren't shot chronologically. Did you ever have to do that whiplash thing where one day you're normal Ellie, the next day you're dead-eyed Ellie, and then back to normal again? Or,
well, you say films aren't shot chronologically. However, we do shoot Evil Dead Rise chronologically.
There you go.
That's because they purpose-built the set for us, and everything was in the one studio space in New Zealand. So we did shoot it chronologically, which was like, oh my God, what a dream. It's what you want for every job.
I can imagine. Yeah, I can imagine that helps.
Yeah, it does. It really does. Because it becomes more and more effortless the more you live in a character and you have experiences as them. Like by season 4 of Vikings, I felt like the prep that I did was so minimal because I had all of this experience living as her. It's just in you. It becomes a part of you in a way that you don't have to sort of muscle in there like you do in the beginning. So it does really help. It's nice to know where you've been and have that feeling when you step onto set.
That fascinates me, the idea that literally the first time we then see you as dead-eyed possessed Ellie in the film is that wonderful shot where you're in the background, the door swings open of the apartment and she's there and she kind of stumbles into the apartment. And that was the first time then you were that character. Do you remember do you remember what that was like? That switch?
I don't really remember what it was like. And I'd done so much prep for movement in Deadite it wasn't the first time I was doing that. It was just the first time it was on camera. So I'd already done a lot. I had a playlist that I'd put together and I would move around my hotel room to this angsty playlist. And I did a lot of rehearsals with the stunt team as well, not just on the stunts that I had to do and the choreography of everything, but also just like some movement stuff. I watched dance videos. I found a great dance video that I sent to Lee very early on. And I was like, I just love the feeling of this. And he seemed to like that too. So we, there were many, many, many hours of moving around as Deadite Ellie before that happened.
I'd like to go in a second, but I just wanted to ask about, there's a moment, I haven't spoken to Lee about this, there's a moment when Ellie is kind of locked outside the apartment and we see a lot of her banging on the door and trying to get in, and we look through the spy hole at her and her glee at times, the sort of the cackling maniacal glee that she takes when she's outside the apartment reminded me a little bit of Cheryl from the first movie. Now, I don't know if you went back and watched the first movie and took cues from that.
That's funny. I did watch it, but I watched it before we were filming and I did not revisit it. So it's hard to answer your question. Did it infiltrate my performance because I'd seen it? Potentially. It wasn't a conscious thing. I know it was written in the script. I mean, I forget the exact things that were written in the script about that moment. Yeah, it wasn't a conscious thing, but I wouldn't say that it was completely uninformed because I had watched the first one.
And then just very, very quickly, talking about the first one, Sam Raimi is also on this week's podcast. I had the pleasure of talking to him last night. Now, I know he wasn't on set because of COVID protocols and whatnot. Yeah. You guys were shooting down in New Zealand as well. Yeah. But have you since had a Sam Raimi experience? And if so, what was it like?
Yeah, we were all at South by Southwest together. It was great. I got to finally meet him and Bruce. And they're just like the OGs, you know. I have so much respect for what they did. The grassroots of it all, and we're just going to put a movie together and do it and make it for ourselves. I love that kind of tenacity. And certainly like he's such a pioneer with some of the camera angles and camera movements and everything, like, deep respect for Sam and everything that he's done. And he was so lovely and complimentary and easy and very comfortable to hang out with. Again, like it's another pinch me moment, you know.
He's a lovely guy. And
very.
The last thing I've got to ask about the playlist. What songs were on the playlist that you were putting together?
It was lengthy, but the songs that I remember mostly, there are a couple of songs from Mezzanine by Massive Attack, and there was one in particular that I would that really kind of got me in my gut. It you know what? Okay, I've probably been misquoting it, so I'm gonna pull it up for you. The phone is out. Spotify's coming out. It is a Pucifer song. It is called Rev 2220. It is the 420 mix.
Right.
That's that. It's a bit on the nose if you're listening to the lyrics, but there was just something about it. There's a few other things on there and some musicians that I won't mention because they've been up to no good and it's come out that they weren't, so I won't give them any press. yeah.
Fair enough. Fair enough. No, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, Alyssa, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. I'm glad to go, but thanks so much.
Thanks so much. Thanks, and Chris.
I hope you have no dreams tonight in which you kill someone.
Hey, but if it happens, that's okay as well.
If it happens, it happens.
Yeah.
And if you happen to dream about the 10 deadliest snakes in the world, then so be it.
Oh, I don't want a snake dream. I'd rather be the person in the powerful position in my dreams rather than having the snake dream. I hate them.
Yeah, same here. Same here. Okay, wish you all the best. Okay. Thanks a lot. What a strange note to end. Cheers. Okay, so that was Alyssa Sutherland, and Sam LeMann is yet to come. So hang tight, Evil Dead fans. Hang tight. Should we talk about this week's movie news?
Yeah, let's.
Why
has
not?
There been any movie news?
Well, there's been Section 31 news. That is news that frankly, news. I banged on about on Pilot as well. But let's do it here too, because it is technically a film. So they talked about this for a while, that Michelle Yeoh, Oscar winner Michelle Yeoh, who played Philippa Georgiou in Star Trek Discovery, and also the Emperor of the Terran Empire in the Mirror Universe, she was an excellent character in Discovery. And there was long talk that she was going to get a spin-off show, which was based around Section 31, which is kind of like Starfleet Special Secret Service intelligence. And it never really came to fruition, but now it is going to come to fruition in a kind of film, which is going to be direct to Paramount Plus. So call it a film, call it a one-off dramatic special event, call it what you like, but it's going to be a single installment, and it's going to come to Paramount Plus, and I for one am very psyched about that. Because she's a great character, and even if Discovery has gone a little bit off the boil, I still got time for the Emperor.
Yeah, she's freaking fantastic, and you know, she's also Michelle Yeoh, and the combination of the two instantly makes this interesting. I don't love the whole concept of Section 31. I like my Federation a little bit less evil than they have sometimes been. But at the same time, you know, it's an interesting direction, I guess, to take the franchise in. So fingers crossed.
And she's just inherently funny because she's a massive sociopath.
She is, yeah, yeah. And does not understand why anyone would do anything for anyone else.
No, she's fabulous.
James, for some reason, globs onto this character. I don't know why, but there it is.
In many ways, the true hero of the Star Trek universe. Yes, Emperor Georgiou.
Always an interesting flex, isn't it, to see what people do after winning an Oscar?
You know, Star Trek, obviously, is the answer.
It is always. It is the only correct answer. Yeah. The only answer James will accept is to do a Star Trek. I can't imagine that it happened much where people have won an Oscar and then immediately gone, I want to do more Star Trek. And I'm sure she will be doing lots more stuff. More stuff will be coming her way. But this is interesting.
Also kind of tangential to TV is that Juno Temple has joined Venom 3. Juno Temple, who was in my face, not literally, last night as I was watching the latest Ted Lasso, which was over an hour long. They are really pushing the boundaries on that show. But they went to Amsterdam on a field trip.
It was a good episode, I thought.
It was fun. Yeah, I liked it. I liked it a lot. But yeah, Juno Temple is going to be in Venom 3, where presumably she will sit in a tank of lobsters.
I think she's probably a good fit, actually, for that franchise.
What, for the tank of lobsters?
Not for the tank of lobsters. I mean, although she would fit. I mean, it was a large tank, and she's a small person. She could absolutely get in the tank if that's a condition of the role. But I just feel like she is kind of very good at that kind of quirky, oddball humor, and also, as you know, Ted Lasso has shown, basically good at all humor. And I feel like she'd be a really interesting fit for that weird ass franchise.
This is not the first superhero movie in which Juno Temple will have appeared alongside Tom Hardy. Can you name the other one?
Is it The Dark Knight Rises?
It is The Dark Knight Rises. Oh, I probably shouldn't have just said superhero movie because that really, really narrowed it down.
It did, yes.
Damn it. I've lost my quiz master skills, dulled by whatever the fuck I have. I don't think it's COVID, but it might be.
Also this week they announced that Pixar's Elemental will be closing Cannes. Good to see that they, you know, they think it's kind of up there with some of the best Pixars have been at Cannes in the past. You know, things like Inside Out. Yeah, yeah, Up and Soul as well. So fingers crossed that's a good sign for Elemental.
Was Soul at the Cannes Film Festival?
Apparently so.
Wow. Yeah. That was like months before it came out,
yeah.
That's interesting. There was a really pointed press release from Pete Docter saying that we're delighted to show this on the big screen, you know, where it belongs, you know, after some of the last few Pixar movies have been taken and used as bait to get people to subscribe to Disney Plus.
Speaking of Disney Plus, there's been Disney Plus news. So since No Way Home kind of brought the previous Spider films into the MCU, kind of tangentially speaking, they are now coming to Disney Plus. So the Sam Raimi Spider-Man films, Amazing Spider-Man, will be on Disney Plus, I believe, by the end of this month. So it's all coming together. All the strands are tied together. You can explore the entire verse in one place.
Should we come around mine and have a big old Amazing Spider-Man and Amazing Spider-Man 2 viewing party? No, God, I didn't think so. Okay.
I am busy that day. It's such a shame. Oh,
yeah.
But I'll probably be busy watching the Fast 10 trailer on a loop because
Momoa.
Even by the standards of the Fast franchise, what the hell is going on? Seriously.
Can I ask a question? Do you think that I could rock a kind of silk heliotrope shirt and matching heliotrope nail polish? Because Momoa does it,
yeah. But he has Momoa power.
He does.
And with the best will in the world, James.
I don't.
I mean, he wore a pink velvet suit to the Oscars with a velvet scrunchie to keep his hair out of his face at the after parties. You know, not everybody can do that. Obviously, you literally can't do the scrunchie part.
I literally can't work the scrunchie.
It's a whole like lifestyle thing. I don't know how you get those powers. I think it involves a lot of surfing, a lot of rock climbing, and a lot of calling people man.
So can we explain what this trailer is for people who may not have seen it, including myself, because I'm actively choosing not to see it because I don't want to... I know it may be a movie that comes pre-spoiled, but
There are spoilers all over the place on the back of the cars.
Hey, I don't want to see this trailer, so I'm not going to see this trailer. But for the people who haven't seen the trailer, just tell me about it. Tell them about it.
This appears to have the son of the drug kingpin Reyes in Fast 5 coming back for revenge, and the way he chooses to take revenge is by going after Dominic Toretto's son. Now, I don't know if you're aware of this, but Dominic Toretto's son is a member of his family, and he takes family quite seriously. So basically, it will be two men who take family seriously out to take each other down. But because they're both the size of mountains, they will do this via the medium of loads and loads of stupid explosions. I didn't really think it was going to be possible to make something dumber than the last few Fast movies, but genuinely this trailer makes me think that they've managed it, guys. So I'm super excited for it.
Yeah, I hear there's some crazy stuff in it, but no, I'm trying to keep myself pure and unspoiled before I go see it in cinemas. Anything else? Were there any more trailers this week? Anything else that you wanted to talk about?
Yeah, there was a trailer for Insidious: The Red Door. So
yes, I did watch.
Back. What did you think?
It looks good. I mean, this is interesting. So this is the fifth and purportedly final Insidious movie, and this is actually directed by Patrick Wilson, who's making his directorial debut on this. I mean, I'll be honest, I didn't love Insidious 3 and 4, but Insidious 1 and 2 are terrific and just absolutely barmy and some amazing jump scares, and they go very, 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 very dilally, very, very quickly, which I love. And so this one kind of continues the story. So we have Patrick Wilson back as Josh Lambert, who, you know, has tried to shut out his connection to the Further, which is a super spooky supernatural place where all the demons hang out. And but his young son Dalton, who, you know, I simply refuse to accept Ty Simpkins growing up. I just refuse to accept it, which is why none of us recognized him when he rocked up at the end of Endgame, of course. But this focuses on him. So Dalton is now older. He's at college and he's beginning to have visions. But he seems to have had all memory of the previous supernatural events, you know, submerged, and then they're beginning to come through. So it looks pretty spooky and cool. And let's hope that that James Wan rubbed off on Patrick Wilson. Not like that. Not in the sex way.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Speaking of not in a sex way, Godzilla X Kong colon, the new empire is coming.
I think there's going to be lots of rubbing off in this. In a sex way. I think this is going to be full on Titan fucking. This is going to be huge.
I mean, well, it will be huge. I think we can definitely, like, that's a guarantee. We know that it's apparently going to delve into the history of these Titans. So who knows? Maybe it'll be literally Mummy Titan and Daddy Titan getting together. But it will look at their origins and the mysteries of Skull Island and beyond, and uncovering a mythic battle that helped forge these extraordinary beings, or whatever. But there's also, of course, a new undiscovered threat hidden in the deeps that's coming for us all.
Some people think that the threat is in the teaser trailer, in which you see a whole bunch of what looks like Titan bones, and they think that there's a sort of Super Kong.
Yeah.
Like a very, very thin
is
version
that what
of
that
Kong.
Is?
Yeah, that's
it
what
looked
people
like,
think
it looked
it
like a cross between the weird, very limb-heavy creatures in Kong Skull Island, but with fur. So yes. I was confused by that.
Interesting. So yeah, this may be. So it's called Godzilla X Kong, which I don't like that naming mechanic. I just don't like it.
It's a Zuma thing, isn't it? It's all about the collabs.
Yeah, it's a collab.
It's a collab.
Get X to fuck.
If it's Godzilla X Kong, then presumably they're just releing a single.
You would think, right? Or they're multiplying, which is what I always take that X to mean.
It's a shoe line, you know.
Maybe it is a shoe line.
It could be a very limited edition range of really giant shoes.
Very big trainers, yeah.
Yeah, huge, huge trainers.
Kong does look like a sneakerhead.
He does, doesn't he? Yeah, I don't know about this one. But this is obviously directed by Adam Wingard again, and I enjoyed the last one, so fingers crossed for this one. And obviously Dan Stevens is in it, so maybe they hack his Twitter account to try and flog MacBooks.
Everyone who goes to see the film gets a free MacBook Pro.
MacBook Pro. So generous of Dan Stevens the last few days to just sell all those MacBooks. Yeah. How the mighty have fallen. And of course, he was hacked, and then he left Twitter in a rather triumphant fashion yesterday.
Yes, he did.
When he finally got control of his account back.
Which apparently took 10 days.
So took 10 days.
There are no fires to put out on Twitter, quite clearly.
Yeah, he had to beat off a lot of American men to get through to the person at Twitter responsible for letting him back into his account. Anyway, one film we haven't really talked about much on the podcast, I think the couple of times we have talked about it, I've had to cut it out for time purposes, is Twisters. Twister. Mm. So,
you have a twin twister. Twister.
Twisters. Never were there such devoted twisters.
Obi-Wan was wise to hide her from me. So Twisters.
Well, there's going to be no actors in this one because the Twisters are doing it for themselves.
Oh, that's good. That is good. So Twisters is a sequel to Twister, which it came out in 1996, Jan de Bont's movie with Bill Paxton, the late great Bill Paxton, and Helen Hunt and Carrie Elwes. And I think it's terrible, but a lot of people love it.
I love it.
But it was one of those early, this is what computer graphics look like films.
Flying cows.
That's what CG was invented for, flying cows.
I just quite like the love story as well. I thought they were fun together.
Yeah.
When
a man and a twister love each other very much.
Yeah. I mean, the love story between the twisters or between Helen Hunt and Bill Paxton.
Sure, but also between Hunt and Paxton. And it's also an incredibly well-cast movie. Down to really small roles.
It's Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Yeah. Terrible film. Anyway, Twisters hopefully will be good. It's going to be directed by Lee Isaac Chung, the director of Minari, who has also dabbled in some Mandalorian. And I think he's one of the directors who's been announced for Skeleton Crew. Isn't that correct? It's one of the few things we didn't talk about in last week's Star Wars Celebration at Palooza section, where we talked about everything but Skeleton Crew and the incredible lineup of directors for that, which is basically like A24's wet dream. So it was like people like David Lowery and Lee Isaac Chung, and it's like this incredible cavalcade of art house talent coming together to do this Star Wars show about a bunch of kids. It's really interesting. Anyway, he's directing Twisters, which seems like an interesting flex, and the cast is being added to with each and every passing day. Daisy Edgar Jones, Glenn Powell. So this is like his first proper big post Top Gun Maverick, one of the world's biggest movie stars in waiting. Just get on it, cast him in things immediately. He's amazing. He's in it as well. And Anthony Ramos. Anthony Ramos is in talks to join them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. This will be following on from his role in Transformers.
Beast Wars or Rise of the Beasts.
Rise of the Beasts.
Beast Wars. Mm, yeah, where he gets to fight giant robot gorillas.
Yeah, so yes. At least he has CG experience at this point. You know,
he does. And I really liked him. I saw The Bad Guys last week, which I missed when it came out in cinemas. And it's really good. It's one of those movies that deserves to do the money that Super Mario Brothers is doing.
Because this was pitched as a kids' Tarantino movie.
Yes, and I can see why it didn't do well. but it's really good, and he's really funny in it as Piranha. But anyway, I think that's pretty much it, unless there's something huge we've missed. But we've given Hollywood as much time as we have probably ever given them. Oh, here's a good one. Maude versus Maude.
Yes. Oh, boy. Yeah.
Angelina Jolie and Halle Berry, who is hilariously refusing to pay the $8 a month for Twitter Blue on Twitter. And she's being very, very funny about it. Angelina Jolie and Halle Berry to lead an action thriller. So that sounds good. I don't really know exactly what it means, but... yes, I am all for that. Let me just see what it's about. It's a Warner Brothers movie. It's an action movie directed by Roseanne Liang from a screenplay written by Scott Mosier. What, Lee Scott Mosier? As in Kevin Smith's producing partner? That's interesting. And it's going to be like a Bond versus Bourne-esque global action thriller. There you go.
Here for it. Absolutely here for it.
Sold. Okay. Well, that is it for this week's movie news. Unless, of course, something major happens in the next 2 hours, in which case we'll try and reconvene. Shall we have another guest?
Okay.
Let's do it, yeah.
Ahead of our discussion of Evil Dead Rise in the reviews section, let us talk about Evil Dead Rise and Evil Dead, the whole Evil Dead franchise, in fact, with one of its co-creators, my beloved possessed goat boy, the greatest director of all time and the director of the greatest movie of all time, Evil Dead 2. It is, of course, Sam Raimi. I am very, very excited to have Sam back in the podcast. It's been far too long. 2013, I believe, was the last time he was on the podcast for All the Great and Powerful. We didn't manage to get him for Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness. But anyway, we do have him for Evil Dead Rise, which he is executive producer of, and of course, which continues the story of the Book of the Dead, the Necronomicon Ex Mortis, or the Naturo Demontum, depending on your depending on which film you're watching, basically, or which mood you're in. It was an absolute delight and a pleasure to talk to Sam Raimi, who is a lovely, earnest, straight-ahead, straight-shooter of a guy. Very, very polite, unfailingly polite, and wants to give lots of credit to his colleagues, but with a lovely, impish sense of humour, as you might expect. We talk mainly about Evil Dead Rise in this interview, but it's me, so I had to talk about Evil Dead 2, and of course... I had to mention that it's the greatest movie ever made. So here we go. Here's me talking to Sam Raimi. Do please enjoy. We are delighted to be joined on the Empire Podcast by the executive producer of Evil Dead Rise, but the granddaddy of the Evil Dead, Sam Raimi. How are you, sir?
I'm feeling a little old as the granddaddy.
I say granddaddy, but I didn't mean grandfather. No way, Sam.
Yes, I did start those Evil Dead movies years ago, and it has been 40-some years now. So I guess the title is earned.
I guess it is. But it's been a while. It's been a while since we had an Evil Dead movie. Obviously, we had Ash versus Evil Dead in between the Fede Alvarez movie and now Lee's movie. But in that time, were you actively trying to get another Evil Dead movie off the ground?
No. Bruce Campbell, Rob Tappert, and myself were not really trying to do that. We loved Fetty's film, his version of The Evil Dead, made in 2013.
Yeah.
And we'd hoped that Fetty would make a sequel, but he was so busy with his other films and so successful that I think it just got a little bit on the back burner. But then I think we realized that Fetty just had bigger fish to fry. And so we started to think about who would be the next writer-director that could take on The Evil Dead. But we didn't want to make it public. We were just really looking for a great artist quietly in the background. And people that I work with, Rommel Adam, Zainab Azizi, told me about this great film. And I saw a hole in the ground, and it really spoke of a great craftsman that is Lee, our director, Lee Cronin. And I felt I really wanted to meet the guy. So we had a lunch and we talked about what he was interested in. And he said he really liked the Evil Dead movies. So I thought, good, that's like very important that he brought it up.
So I love that. You know, I've spoken to Lee as well. And, you know, he was saying that yeah, it's very much a case that he brought it up towards the end of your meeting. Was that the case where you have your meetings with other directors and not bringing Evil Dead up in the hope that maybe they would bring it up? Was that how it worked for a while?
Not, I wasn't really having meetings with directors hoping they would bring up the Evil Dead. I was just looking for a really great craftsman who I connected with on a personal level and felt I could trust the franchise so that to take the, for them to take the next step in the franchise.
Mm. And I love what Lee has done with it. I think it's an absolutely tremendous take on the Evil Dead. But I have to say, Sam, as well, did you ever think that you had maybe the perfect director for an Evil Dead movie sitting right under your nose, i.e. yourself? Was that something that ever crossed your mind?
You're funny. Do you mean to make the next installment of Evil Dead?
Yes, yes.
Well, I love working with Bruce Campbell and Rob Tappert. And the idea that I could work with Bruce again would have been incredible. But because Bruce had done the series really for a lot of different directors, with a lot of different directors, I read that he had hung up his chainsaw. I read that online. I went, oh, I guess there goes my opportunity. But if I could have done it with Bruce, because he's such a good friend of mine, and it's such a personal, friendly experience working with him, I would have definitely done it.
Well, you never know. You never know. Never say never, right?
That's right. Except when you just said never say never.
But you should never say never. And then like it gets confusing after a while. Who knows where we end up. But Lee obviously has this incredible pitch, and you know, he brings a lot to the movie. It's not just about a change in location. It's not just about a different focus in heroes. You know, he has this focus on a family unit this time around and brings children into the picture as well, which I thought was really interesting.
A terrible, terrible man.
He's a terrible, terrible human being, and nobody is safe as long as he's around. But from your point of view, what else did he bring to the Evil Dead that made it different from what you had done?
Well, he really is a very good writer, and I was never a good writer. So he understands character, and he understood that the real potential in the Evil Dead movies were that these demonic spirits take over your friends and loved ones and turn them against you. So he took that idea and he came up with the idea that it would be about a family, because what better unit of love between people could there be than that? And therefore, the possibilities of turning them against each other, you know, the dramatic implications of that would be tenfold what they were with just a bunch of friends at a cabin or another location. So he used his skills as a storyteller to recognize what could be most effective given our brand of monsters and the way they worked.
And obviously you weren't on set, but you were watching dailies coming through because he was shooting down in New Zealand. Was there a moment or a particular, I don't know, whether a particular day or a particular scene that made you think, oh yes, we're in safe hands here. This feels like an Evil Dead movie.
I was first impressed by the quality of the performances that he got from Lily Sullivan, Alyssa Sutherland, and all the actors. So when those dailies came through, I was watching thinking, this is going to be incredibly effective, even though I haven't seen the horror yet. Mm-hmm. Just the reality of the people and the investment in them that he made was very unusual for a horror film. And I thought, that is really going to pay off. But of course, then when I saw the makeup and the makeup tests early on before the dailies, I really felt that he had nailed the Evil Dead feeling while still updating it and making it his own thing.
Yeah, it's interesting. For example, the eyes are different this time around. You used to go with kind of opaque white eyes for your deadites, and Lee's gone with a sort of yellowish tinge. It's which intrigued me.
Yeah, he's trying to make it his own, and he certainly did in so many more important ways than that. But yes, he wanted a unique feel to his deadites, and he created that very well with his makeup team and his production designers and concept artist. He really is not just a great writer, but he's a great director. He knows how to lead a crew, and then he knows the effect of the camera, which is really one of the most important aspects of making an Evil Dead movie, I think, which is you've got to paint a picture of the supernatural, and you've got to leave a lot of negative space for the audience to put their own visions and dreams and nightmares into the thing. And the camera really helps in describing, it can help in describing that which is unseen, that which exists beyond our world. And Lee understands that, and in his own way, different than me, but he is an artist with a camera. And I think that was one of the most important things that made the movie so, that makes the movie so effective.
I think one of the interesting things about this movie is, and in fact, Fede's movie as well, is that they both, I think, hew closer to the tone and the spirit of the first Evil Dead movie, which is this, you know, the ultimate experience in grueling terror. It is this very gnarly, very nasty, unrelenting horror film. And obviously that's a tone you began to move away from in Evil Dead 2 and almost completely then for Army of Darkness. Was that something that you talked about with both Fede and Lee about a return to that tone in a way?
It wasn't even me directing them to a particular tone. It was talking with Rob Tappert, Bruce Campbell, Rommel Adam about what type of movie he wanted to make of an Evil Dead movie. And when he gave us his ideas, they seemed, yes, that's more like the first Evil Dead, but I didn't guide him there. I don't think that we wanted to make a humorous version of Evil Dead this time around. I think that came about because Bruce and I, in high school, had always made Super 8 movies that were just comedies. And when we went to make our horror film, we had to kind of, Evil Dead 1, put a straight face on and be as serious, pretend serious as possible to scare the audience. But that really wasn't our thing. We're comedians. And when we got a chance to make Evil Dead 2, and Ash was the only survivor, we felt a little more comfortable in our own skins and started to add some of what we really do best, which is a little bit of the lighter comedy into the thing. And even more so in an insane dumbbell way in Army of Darkness. So I think that came out of my relationship with Bruce for a lifetime of comedy. And we didn't want to force that artificially on any film artist who was trying to make an Evil Dead film. Had they a great comedian, yeah, that they had worked with and they told us they wanted to take on that tone, I think we would have been, I would have been doubtful probably, but knowing Lee, I'm sure I would have been rewarded.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm glad you brought up Evil Dead 2 there, Sam, or maybe I brought it up. One of us brought it up anyway, because regular listeners to this podcast will know of my feelings on Evil Dead 2 in particular. I'm a huge fan of this franchise. Sam, I'm not going to embarrass you by saying that I think it's the greatest movie of all time.
You just embarrassed me. Oh, you're not going to say that.
I'm not going to say that. So don't worry. That's off the table. That is off the table. So I'm not going to say that.
But, wow.
But if I were to think that, it would mean that I would have to ask about it. And, you know, talking about Bruce and his performance is incredible. Directing Bruce Campbell must be one thing. Directing Bruce Campbell's possessed hand must be something else entirely. What was that experience like for you?
Well, Bruce is just such a great physical comedian. And that was my experience working with him with my high school pals, Scott Spiegel, Bill Kirk, John Cameron, Josh Becker. We would make Super 8 movies and they were always slapstick. So that was all of our training. So it's more like Bruce was unleashed to do his thing finally in Evil Dead 2. And it was a pleasure and it was funny to watch him and great to collaborate with him. And we'd both crack up after the takes, you know, unless Bruce was like bleeding from the harm he had done to himself. But it was an absolute joy to work with Bruce. He's a great guy and can really make you laugh. He's a really funny guy. Besides his physical comedy, he's got a great wit about him.
On set of that movie, who was making the, did anyone make the noises for the hand as was possessed? Or was that something, I mean, obviously you added it in post, but on set, were you making noises for the hand to help Bruce with his performance?
I didn't make noises when he was doing it because I didn't want to disturb him or ruin the soundtrack. I wanted to have a clean recording of his grunts and gasps. Didn't want to have to loop them in post-production. But in the ADR, the dialogue replacement part of a movie making, I did a lot of the sounds of the hand myself and stuff like that. I hope you have the good taste to remove that from your podcast, but if not, I wouldn't be surprised.
Good taste and I are a strange bedfellow, Sam.
Okay, then.
What can I say? And obviously, you know, we've talked a lot about how, you know, obviously there was a 10-year gap between Fede's movie and this movie. There was a 20-year gap between Army of Darkness and Evil Dead. Was that a situation where when Army of Darkness wrapped and you began to go off and you began to spread your wings, you know, making, you know, Quick of the Dead and For Love of the Game and The Gift and obviously then into the Spider-Man movies, was there a point where you almost couldn't envisage someone else making an Evil Dead movie? Did you feel territorial about it? Did you feel almost proprietorial about it as a director?
I think it was two things. That was one of them is like, that's what Bruce and I do. And how would we give that to somebody else to do?
Yeah.
It didn't quite add up. So I guess territorial is the right word. Didn't understand how someone could move on with that. Cause it seemed like it was all about Bruce's magic, you know, or absurd nonsense, whatever you want to call it. But I didn't know how somebody else was going to go forward with that without our relationship, without Bruce starring in it. And I know that Bruce really wanted to do it with me. And I thought that it was in my past. I just would go forward making different types of pictures, trying to develop as a director, trying to grow and learn about the craft of filmmaking. And those movies, by the way, were never successful. None of them really made money when they were opened in the theaters. They cost us a tremendous amount of time and our personal money. And it didn't seem like the kind of thing that you'd go back and make a fourth one after you've made three that were basically unsuccessful in the theaters. So there was no real demand for it, I thought. But then by the time I got to make Spider-Man and Spider-Man 2 with Tobey Maguire and Kirsten Dunst and a bunch of great producers, I'd be talking about the movies and people would say, that's great, but when is the next Evil Dead movie coming out? And I'd think, what? I don't understand. Isn't that over with? And I thought that they were, it didn't make any sense to me. And then I finally opened my ears and thought, I guess they want another Evil Dead movie. These kids won't shut up. So I just felt, okay, we'll get the best filmmaker we can find and we'll start developing a Evil Dead movie and that will be the end of it. And so we got Fede Alvarez and he did such a brilliant job. I love his movie. And he was such a pleasure to work with. He's a great guy. He's a personal friend of mine. So I might be biased, but the audience seemed to really dig that also. And so that's when I think Rob, Bruce and I realized, oh, this is so much bigger than just Bruce and I doing our shtick. The audience likes these Evil Dead movies. So we made we were hoping Fede would write a sequel, but he was on and off to greater and bigger things. And so my brother and I wrote a pilot for Ash vs. Evil Dead, hoping that would quiet the fans. And then that ran for three seasons and Bruce put his all into it. And I never expected to make another Evil Dead movie, but there was a small but vocal crowd that did enjoy that. And it was a very small crowd, but they were insistent. So now we're in the business of listening and trying to find the best filmmakers we can, the most talented visualists and people who are also great writers. And now we're actively going to make some Evil Dead movies. This is for the first time since never.
Wow. Well, I'm very, very excited. Very excited indeed. And Sam, I know I have to let you go. I have to ask about Ash without giving too much away. I know there is a moment in the film where Bruce appears. We won't say where it is or in what form, but Lee told me recently that in his head he thinks that Bruce cameo could be Ash. So you know, are you open to that? Are you open to bringing Bruce back and hand at all as Ash?
Yeah, I'm always open to that, and I want to please the fans. The fans in London gave us our start. Nobody would touch the movie. And Bruce and I were very down, along with Rob Tappert, all very depressed that we couldn't sell our movie. And it was Palace Pictures in London with Stephen Woolley and Nick Powell who gave us our chance and released the film through Palace Pictures. And after that, I think after reaching the depths of despair of failure in the filmmaking business, and then having somebody give us a chance, I think anything is possible. I really do believe that, and especially in this nutty business of show business. So I do believe Bruce and I could work together again, and I'd love to. I love him, and I'm constantly communicating with him as a friend and a creative partner.
Amazing. By the way, I hosted the other night, a couple of Q&As with Lee at the Prince Charles Cinema, which I know was a big film for you guys whenever The Evil Dead was getting off the ground over here.
It was. What a great theater. And is it still in all its glory as it was many years ago?
I think they've upgraded the seats and they've washed the floors, but otherwise it's pretty much the same.
That's great. Yeah, that is a beautiful theater. And that always drew the coolest crowds, the most hip individuals, the most outrageous people, and like the just free thinkers. I remember thinking that when Evil Dead played there, that this would never be met with the same positive reaction as it was in the United States at our test screenings.
Oh well, it played incredibly the other day in front of an audience. It was great. Lee told me at one point, again not to give too much away, but we left after the first introduction, and he said, stick around. I want to see how they react to the scalping. And they went nuts. They went nuts for the scalping. What can I say, Sam? We're sickos.
Thank you for your sickness. You gave me my chance.
Indeed. And then just real quick. What does the future hold for both you and the Evil Dead franchise? It's been a year now, pretty much, since Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness. Can we expect to see you behind the camera calling the shots again on something soon?
I'd really like to. I'm writing with my brother. I'm looking for a good script, something that I think I could be additive to, something I could bring something to, and that rings to me like the audience would really be thrilled with this.
Well, fingers crossed something like that comes your way. And Lee was telling me that he has tentative plans put in place for two more films. Is that your hope?
I'd love to work with Lee again in any capacity. He's really a professional and a really nice guy and a fantastic filmmaker to learn from. That's what you do as a producer. When you watch these dailies come in, you think, oh my God, I never would have thought to tell the actor that. And look what he got from it. Because you listen to a lot of what's going on behind the scenes with the microphones running and rolling, and you watch the directors direct, and Lee's a great director. And so, yes, I think I'd love to work with him on almost any project that he really believed in.
Amazing. Well, Sam, it's been a pleasure as always. And thanks so much for your time.
Thanks so much. Have a great day.
Okay, so that was Sam Raimi. And now let's talk about Evil Dead Rise. It is time for the reviews section. Jimbo, have you seen Evil Dead Rise?
I have not. I have not because I took a stand and refused to see it. Because frankly, I don't have the constitution for it. Like, Helen has seen it, and I saw Helen's face when she came out of the screening of this, and she looked like she had been to the other side, and not in a good way. And I just genuinely, I was just like, there was a lovely screening. It was at Battersea Power Station, which I've never been to, the screening there. I was quite excited to go to there. And I just thought, do you know what? I just don't think I've got the fortitude to watch this film. Someone said the words cheese grater to me, and I'm like, nope, that's it. I'm out. I'm done. I can't do it. My ability to withstand nasty horror has dwindled, I think, as I've got older. And I just didn't think I was up to it. So I was too scared, is what I'm saying. I was too scared to watch Evil Dead Rise.
Oh, Freddy Cat Dyer.
Yeah. I was too afraid.
You'll watch limbs being lopped off in Vikings, and you'll watch people being stabbed left, right, in front in Red Dwarf, but you won't.
I know. I was a big old scaredy cat, and I couldn't do it.
Decapitations galore in Star Trek Picard, but no, you stick him in. You stick him in an Evil Dead movie, and he runs a mile.
It's true.
Yeah, you've missed out. You have missed out.
But I mean, Helen, be honest. Like, no. How would I have? This would have done me.
Yeah,
in, right?
I disrecommended it to you. Yeah. I would disrecommend it to all Freddy cats and everyone who doesn't like children in peril situations. However, it's a freaking fantastic scary movie. Like, it is a brilliant scary movie. So it's obviously Lee Cronin directing, Sam Raimi, of course, producing, still there, giving it his, you know, his sign off, as it were. But yeah, it's the story of Beth, Lily Sullivan's character, who comes to visit her sister, which is Alyssa Sutherland's Ellie, and Ellie's kids in their apartment in LA. Beth is struggling with some decisions that she has to make in her own life, and is kind of coming to her sister for advice, but she finds her sister overworked, overwhelmed, already dealing with her own shit, kind of just trying to keep it together. And that's before, you know, the kids go downstairs exploring and find something that they probably shouldn't have found, and get involved in something they probably shouldn't have gotten involved with, and let loose the forces of hell in the apartment. I mean, we've all been there. I think it's very relatable in that sense. But yes, it is. Things get very, very bad from there on. And it's not just that there are, you know, horrible moments in this and a bit with the cheese grater that you've probably seen in the trailer and various kind of bits of body horror. It's also just genuinely incredibly tense, incredibly scary. I was at a, you know, a guitar string or something the entire way through, going, what's going to happen now? There's going to be something scary in a minute. If nothing scary was happening at that second, you knew that there was going to be something scary any other second. So you're just sitting there the whole time, incredibly tense, just waiting for it to happen. And I feel like on the Evil Dead scale, this very much comes in at the scarier end of the spectrum. I feel like there is some humor in it, and I did laugh at times, but not enough to stop me being fucking terrified. But it's not, it's certainly, you know, it's certainly more Evil Dead or Evil Dead 2 than it is Army of Darkness. Like, that's a very, very clear difference.
It's not even Evil Dead 2. It's not, you know, it's Evil Dead 2 is this.
That's true. Yeah. Very, Evil Dead more, isn't it?
Gonzo.
Yeah.
Comedy horror, I would say. Army of Darkness is full on comedy, with now and again it remembers that just meant to be an Evil Dead movie and throws one in just to keep people like me happy. But no, this is a full on Evil Dead movie. Although it's got this sort of sick sense of humor, I would say more so than Fede Alvarez's Evil Dead, which was 10 years ago.
Which is pretty good. It wasn't, I mean, we liked that movie as well, or certainly I did.
Well, I went back and revisited it recently because I remember it being, it's an unrelenting movie. And tonally, it's so dark. It is so dark. There's no levity. There's levity, but there's no levity in that movie at all. But there is levity here. It does have a twisted sense of humor that Evil Dead doesn't. And actually, if you go back to the first Evil Dead, Sam Raimi's the first Evil Dead, which is, obviously it's a very, very lo-fi and chunky and DIY and all that stuff. And, you know, the last 5 minutes is a plasticine orgy, essentially, and the effects aren't great. And it's a little bit slapdash and amateurish at times. But this has much more in common with that than it does with the other films in the franchise. Lee Cronin himself actually thinks there is more Evil Dead 2 DNA in there.
Oh, yeah.
But for me, it's definitely the Evil Dead. DNA, because it is bleak, it is unrelenting, it is grim, it is nasty, and bad things happen to good people.
Yeah, and I feel like it shows Cronin's huge knowledge of horror generally. I feel like there are obvious nods to other films, one of which, like, everyone's already talked about in the reviews, but there is a nod to The Shining, for example. But at the same time, like, it does feel Evil Dead-y, even though they've gotten away from the cabin, they've gotten away from the sort of the visual language of a lot of that. It still feels Evil Dead-y. There is a scene at the beginning with a different group of people in a cabin, so you still get that hit. If that's what you're looking for, a bit of cabin porn, it's there. But although if you're going to Evil Dead movies for your cabin porn, you're doing it way wrong. Yeah, so it was really good. I also want to mention the kids. I think the kids in this, the child performances were fantastic. God knows how they kept them safe on set. I'm sure it was a fascinating conversation basically daily to keep those kids engaged and you know, protected, especially Nell Fisher, who's the youngest of the kids, but Gabriel Eccles and Morgan Davies, who are the two sort of teenagers in the family, I thought were absolutely fantastic. Really, really great performances from them. I hope it leads to big things. But yeah, look, I was just terrified. I was absolutely terrified. I was amused at times, and I was surprised often by the turns and the twists that it took. But it is terrific, but it's not for everyone.
By everyone, you mean me. It's not for me.
I mean you. And honestly, I mean never watching it again myself. Like, I mean, yeah. I'm very pleased that I saw it, and I'm not sure when I'm going to have the constitutional fortitude to watch it again. But I hope I do someday.
I've seen it in three different times now, and each in a slightly different way. So the first time I saw this was completely on my own. And it still worked for me. Yeah. I was in a screen room on my own, and that was at one point like a gust of wind, like a little draft blew on me, and I was like, oh shit, that's not good. Like you look around, is there a deadite? No. Is it Bruce Campbell? No, it's not. Second time was on a computer, which is, you know, obviously not great, but it still worked. Then the third time was with an audience. I, you know, full disclosure, I did a couple of Q&A's with Lee Cronin last week, as mentioned in the Sam Raimi interview, and at the Prince Charles in London. And as we were doing the second, after we did the second introduction, we were walking out the door, and Lee turned to me and said, oh, wait, I want to stay for the scalping and just see how it goes so down in an audience. And watching it with an audience, there's, you know, it is dark. It is violent. It's extremely violent. It's extremely bloody. And again, bad things happen to good people. But Jimbo, you would like it because it's also got its crowd pleasing moments, and it's got its punch the air moments, and it's, you know, it's interesting because I think it's the first proper Evil Dead movie that has taken its way from, obviously there's only been two without Bruce Campbell and without Ash, but it's the first one I think to really properly invoke the spirit of Ash without feeling like a retread of Ash in a way.
Army of Darkness remains my favorite Evil Dead, partly because I think I saw the first Evil Dead when I was obviously far too young to see it, and the effect it had on me was really quite severe, like, because it is a really, really nasty film, and I don't think I was quite prepared for how unpleasant it was going to be watching that. And to this day, like, I like scary horrors. I like psychological horrors. I do not like sadism in films, and I don't like nasty, nasty stuff in horror films like that. It just really affects me. So it's definitely not one that I have the fortitude for.
There we go. But you would like it because there's a lot of aliens in this DNA as well.
That's aliens. That's actually true. Yeah.
In his DNA. It's basically like Lee Cronin has shoved an Evil Dead movie, Aliens, and Demons 2 into a blender.
I've seen Demons 2.
Yeah. So, but less overtly comedic than Demons 2, but it does have some of the same stuff going on. I loved it. I thought it was terrific. You know, regular listeners will know I have a soft spot for these movies, and this is for me the second best Evil Dead movie. After Army of Darkness, of course, which is actually the fourth best Evil Dead movie. So there we go. 4 stars then for Evil Dead Rise.
Rise.
Next, we come to a film called Ghosted, which could also have been the title for Evil Dead Rise, I'm guessing it could. I spec.
The ability to ghost does not make you intelligent.
So this is the first film post-Rocket Man for Dexter Fletcher, and it teams Chris Evans and Ana de Armas for the third time. So they were in Knives Out, a Benoit Blanc mystery together, and they were in The Gray Man together as well. So they've kind of been adversarial, shall we say, in both of those movies. But this time, they're getting it on. Boom, chicka, wow, wow.
That's the plot of the film.
Yeah. I'll be honest, I passed out after their lovemaking scene. I just assumed the rest was just wall-to-wall fucking. No, of course not. But James, you've seen this one.
I have seen this one.
This is the film you've seen. So
this is the film I've seen. I was not traumatized by this one. It was nasty, obviously, but not in that way. Just
what
in
about
the
cheese grater scene? Did you like that?
I must admit, that caught me by surprise.
Let's talk about this one. What happens in Ghosted, and who does it happen to, and is it worth seeing?
Well, this is, of course, an Apple film, and it stars Chris Evans as a lonely farmer who can't get a girlfriend. But wait, come back. I know suspension of disbelief is difficult, so just bear with me. He, while working his little farm store, while selling his dairy goods. That wasn't a euphemism. He's literally working a farm stall. He's selling goods at the market, and he comes across, steady,
come on now,
a young woman called Sadie, who wants to buy a plant. He ultimately, unwillingly sells her a plant, and the two of them go for a walk. They spend a lovely day together, and yes, they end up in the bed, under the sheets, having the sex. And it's lovely for him. He hasn't had a girlfriend in a long time. He's been very, very lonely, so he does what all people would do. He spams her with needy text messages, driving her away, and she completely ghosts him, as with the title. But not one to be deterred, because as we said, very unattractive man, can't get a girlfriend. He decides, since he knows where she's going, for reasons, he decides to surprise her by going to London, which is where she is because she's a quote-unquote art curator. He decides to surprise her in London. So he turns up in London, promptly gets abducted by henchmen and finds out that she is an international super spy. Hijinks
we've
then
all been there.
Ensue. Yeah, it is. I mean, it does seem to be, as you pointed out in your review, Helen, the plot of every romance in Hollywood, that there is a significant chance that whoever you fancy will turn out to be a secret spy. But the thing with this, and I know you didn't maybe enjoy it as much as maybe I enjoyed it, but I found, because Chris Evans and Ana de Armas are both so inherently obviously attractive, but just very, very charming, I was carried along purely by the kind of I love you, I hate you thing that they have going on all the way through this film. And it's a lot of fun. I do think, and this is an interesting one. So there's a show that I can't actually review on Monday's pilot because it's embargoed, but this show reminded me a lot of this film. I think they have a lot of things in common.
MasterChef.
It was MasterChef, the professional setup, right? But I think the thing with this that threw me slightly is it's tonally uneven. Like, at times, it feels like it's a lighthearted action comedy, and at times, it feels like it's a full-on nonsense slapstick spy caper. And it's almost like it can't quite decide what line it wants to walk. So it starts very much in the former camp and then gets progressively sillier and sillier as it goes. And it ends in this absolutely deranged set piece, which makes no sense according to the laws of, you know, plots or physics. But and also I should point out there is a running gag involving cameos in this which just didn't work for me at all. But despite all of that, I really liked them and I quite enjoyed the film and I thought it gave me the warm and fuzzies and I thought it was okay. So it's not a masterpiece, it's not, but I thought it was quite good. I quite liked it.
Helen, you gave us 2 stars. Why did you not like the nice film with the pretty people directed by the nice man with the big hair?
I did want to like it. I expected to like it. I really, really did. Obviously, two beautiful people, both of whom I think highly of as performers. I think they're charismatic as well as gorgeous and talented. I find him fundamentally miscast. I think he is absolutely the wrong person to play that role.
I think that's fair.
But I'm glad
he did play it.
I get why he would want to. I just don't think he can.
Should it have been me?
It should have been you, yes.
It would have been more realistic.
Yes, more realistic that Chris would have somehow wooed Ana de Armas. Yes, that is 100%
that is completely realistic.
100% realistic.
That is very realistic.
You've seen Fallout. That is realistic. It's the rest. So I had a bit of a problem with that. And I find, I just think he's got too much innate confidence for you to buy him as this fish out of water, this guy who's perpetually at sea in this film. So I had a bit of a problem with that. I agree about the tone. I think the tone is all over the place. I find the cameos fun, but again, tonally, completely.
Yeah, I think that was my issue. It pulled me out of the story because I'm like, this is just silly.
Yeah, and the running joke about her exes, what was that? That was, again, super silly. Again,
that's almost Naked Gun territory. Like, yeah. It was properly silly.
And then I think she's wearing a wig and I find it distracting. It's not a good wig.
I don't think it's a wig.
It's a wig.
As the hair expert on this podcast.
If you look at the parting.
You sound like Mahoney in Police Academy. Wig alert, wig alert.
Yeah, that's what Helen was doing.
With the utter confidence that you have right now that is a wig. I think Helen has
far more hair than both of us combined. I think she is probably the expert. I didn't notice it. I thought it was just like highlights.
James, the amount of hair that you have does not make you an expert on hair.
Oh yeah, no, she's getting trolled for her wig and has been getting trolled since the trailer came out. So,
but what if it isn't a wig? Like, everyone thought that Andy Serkis's hair
Him of that on stage at the live podcast to be told that it was not, in fact, a wig. Yes.
The person who's more likely to be wearing a wig and ghosted is Chris Evans. What if he's absolutely bald? And that's just a very, very, a convincing wig.
Literally, there are tweets going, is the wig that bad on purpose? I'm not alone here. I'm not on my own.
Just because people think it is, it doesn't mean it is.
Okay.
I feel like we're getting hung up on the wig.
Because it's a wig.
Why would it be a wig? She's got hair. We've all seen her hair.
Time.
But it doesn't have to be long. Why does her hair have to be long? She could have had short hair.
They could have just used her hair, but they didn't. They used a wig.
She's an attractive lady. She can have short hair.
She's a very attractive lady. Yes, she could have.
I'm sorry. This is wigaganda. I can't do it. I'm out.
Wow.
5 stars to the wig, 2 stars to ghosted. I don't, this is a perfectly, this is a fun film, Helen. Well, why, you know.
It was a high two. It was a high two. There was, it's not that I didn't get any enjoyment from it, but I cannot in good conscience recommend it over not recommending it. Do you know what I mean? It's not, and I like a big stupid action movie. I do. I had a good time at The Gray Man. I had less of a good time at this.
Yeah, I had more time at The Gray Man. The Gray Man is unabashed fun, but The Gray Man, I think, knows what it is, and it's tonally even all the way through. This just seems to jump about a little bit.
One thing I thought about this was that I don't think The Gray Man is the film you compare it to. I think what you compare it to is The Lost City, or you compare it to even Shotgun Wedding, which came out in January. Mm. And I think perhaps the screenplay, I just think the screenplay needed an extra draft.
Yeah.
Just to punch up the singers a little bit to make sure that the chemistry, the crackling back and forth didn't crackle for me in this. Yeah. And there's some really, I think there's some good sequences. I laughed at the cameo palooza that we get halfway through. I thought that was a very, very funny idea, and it was actually well executed. There's a kind of jarring blend of real location work on actual locations and then not so great green screen work.
Yeah. Very true.
And the blending of the two doesn't always work for me.
Yes. It made me excited for Ballerina, though, because she has the moves. And I thought she was very, very convincing as a super spy. So
she does have the moves. She does indeed have the moves. 2 stars then for Ghosted. And just very, very quickly as well, Helen, you saw Missing this week.
I did see Missing. Yeah, this is in the vein of Searching a couple of years ago, the John Cho movie.
It's a sequel to Searching, isn't it?
Well, yeah, but
it's a spiritual sequel.
Yeah, it doesn't share a lot of characters, but it's the same idea. Everything is on screen. You're basically watching June, played by Storm Reid.
June!
Storm Reid's coming, Annie. Better get home quick.
You don't have to hide at home from her. She's a good actress. But yeah, so she is basically an 18-year-old kind of, you know, chomping at the bit to get away from her overprotective single mother, Grace, who's played by Nia Long. But Grace is away. She's going away for a week with her new boyfriend, Kevin, played by Ken Leung. And they're going to Colombia. And Grace is leaving June at home, and she's basically deciding to party it up. Until Grace doesn't come back when she's supposed to. The flight lands, but she is not aboard. And June is left trying to figure out what on earth has happened to her mum. Where has she been? Where has she gone? And try and put the pieces together of her disappearance. So we're seeing this all basically through her computer screen. We're seeing it through, you know, FaceTime calls, just FaceTime being on in the background. So the camera, the laptop camera is on. You know, there's a bit of security footage at time, clever use of that. There's Task Rabbit's use, where she tries to recruit somebody in Colombia to go and look for her mum and figure out what's happened. It's cleverly done. I think, if anything, it actually justifies the whole, you know, screen usage, maybe a little better than Searching did, but it has the same kind of, you know, tension, and it has the same kind of propulsiveness. It's takes place over a slightly longer period than Searching did, but it still manages to feel propulsive. The one thing I would say is that I guessed a couple of major plot developments in this.
Did
and
you?
I'm not usually that good at that. So I feel like
I didn't at all.
Really?
Yeah, I guessed nothing.
Oh, okay.
It had me at every turn, and it twists and turns a lot.
A lot,
and
yeah.
And I was yanked by the nose through all of them.
Oh, well then. Okay, so that's good. But I did think it worked even then. And, you know, great performance from Reid, and obviously a great performance from Long, who's always fantastic. But yeah, it was pretty tense there.
Do you know
what?
It's like the whole screen life thing, it seems a bit like an eye-rolling kind of conceit. It feels like a gimmick. And I think what works for me about this film is, if this hadn't used this sort of that particular format, I think it still works. Like, I think the story is strong enough that it stands on its own, and I genuinely really enjoyed the way they shot this. Like, there's a part where she shuts down, or she's going to shut down her Mac, and they managed to make a cursor hovering over a shutdown button incredibly tense. And they use really inventive ways of keeping the kind of conceit, the screen life conceit, going, where she buys a watch that has a camera in it so we can follow her about. There's security cameras. There's, and I mean, obviously she keeps her laptop on all the time, which is terrible for the environment, but sure, so we can see what you're doing. And I thought it was wonderful. And I think there's something about the evolution from having John Cho's character in Searching, who's like a middle-aged man, to a native Zoomer who eats, sleeps, and breathes connectivity.
Yeah.
And it feels so organic that, of course, she does everything digitally, because she's of the generation that does do everything digitally. And it doesn't feel contrived. And I think that was the big thing for me. It didn't feel false. It didn't feel contrived. And I just felt like a very active thing. Although after this film finished, I was extremely pleased to just go outside and knock me in front. I don't know. It made me want to disconnect is what it did.
Sounds great. And one to watch at home, perhaps, where you can zoom in and everything and see all the different clues. Because in searching, there was various things that implied that there was also some sort of alien invasion happening at the same time.
Yeah, I did want to read. I read some of the Chirons, the news Chirons, as I went past, but I really wanted to have more time and read more of those because there were some quite funny things going on in the background.
All right, 4 stars then for Missing, which we should say is directed by Will Merrick and Nick Johnson. Finally, we have a live action adaptation of the animated classic Dog Tanyan and the Three Musca Hounds. Helen, it's exciting, isn't it?
You are a monster. What has happened here? Musca Hounds are always ready. I love it too. But a little bit of respect here. Alexandre Dumas' classic novel has been adapted many times.
I think it's Alexandre Dumas.
Many, many times through the years. For my money, this might be the best. It is certainly the best since the Richard Lester one in the 70s. And honestly, it might be better. I think this is a fantastic, fantastic Musketeers adaptation. So this is the French basically taking it back and then casting a bunch of superstars in a sort of Avengers-esque, you know, lineup to make it exciting and good. So you've got Vincent Cassel, Romain Duris, and Pio Marmaille as the Musketeers themselves, as Athos, Aramis, and Porthos, respectively. You have François Civil, who I didn't really know well before because I haven't watched the original Call Your Agent, but he is D'Artagnan. He is the only person I have ever seen challenge Michael York as best D'Artagnan. He is utterly fantastic. So he is basically the young kid who rides from Gascony to Paris to join the Musketeers. Along the way, on a dark and stormy night, not storm raid, he comes upon a crime being committed and it gets into a scuffle and is left behind, none the wiser as to what actually has happened. But it turns out to be part of a giant conspiracy involving Eva Green's Milady, involving Cardinal Richelieu, played by Eric Ruff, and involving King Louis XIII, played by Louis Garrel, who people may know from Little Women.
Where Florence Pugh dies.
Yeah, in A Hail of Bullets.
Again, you cannot repeat these incorrectnesses. Look, what follows is at times very, very faithful to Dumas. So they've got things like basically D'Artagnan rocking up in Paris and almost immediately getting himself involved in 3 duels against all 3 musketeers separately. He has them stacked up at like 11 noon and 1 o'clock, one after another. He sticks to things like that. He sticks to Anne of Austria being involved with the Duke of Buckingham and giving him a diamond necklace, not a euphemism. he gets involved, you know, he sticks to so many of those kind of iconic bits of the story, but he also brings out some of the real history. This is, when I say he, I'm talking about like director Martin Bourboulon and his team. They're bringing in elements of the wars of religion. They're bringing in elements of like xenophobia and paranoia and this kind of enemy within. And, you know, we're one country under one God, united. We don't trust those people who have that other religion. You know, there's genuine modern resonance to this Musketeers movie, which is not something I expected when I went in. But it also delivers on big old sword fights and people jumping on galloping horses and, you know, cannons exploding and masked balls and just everyone wearing the most incredible floppy hats. It's an absolute joy from start to finish. I could nitpick. I could say that at times the plot is a little bit overly complicated as a result of all these new elements that they've added in. This is, of course, one of 2 planned parts. So you might argue that there's some threads left dangling at the end that you would prefer to be tied up. Just come back in December, I think it is, for the second part. But I just think it's magnificent. It's genuinely the best Musketeers movie, like I say, since at least the Lester and maybe the best ever. Flawless.
Flawless?
Pretty much.
Wow.
Apart from the confusing bits, you know. I've seen it, I saw it twice in a week and I would go back and see it again in an instant.
What about the action? Because I saw one person tweet that the action was incoherent.
I think they're referring really to that opening fight in the rain, in the dark, and you can't quite tell easily who's who and what's what. And I think that's probably true. But I saw a lot of people talking about quick cutting in the other fights. And actually, the most kind of mind-catching, if you like, fight scenes that I remember are the ones where they did a sort of fake one-er and they have the camera kind of following people through this little forest where they're having this brawl and going from one person to the next person to the next person. And so there wasn't a lot of quick cutting. So I was a bit confused by that criticism, to be honest, because I didn't think it was what I'd seen. Having said that, look, this was made, I think both films were $72 million total. So I feel like, you know, it's not as huge a budget as it looks. It looks like it's a mega huge budget, but it isn't. So maybe they've had to cut some corners on some of the fight scenes. But honestly, I thought it was pretty good.
All right. So Helen would give this 4 stars. 4 étoiles for D'Artagnan and the Three Musketeers.
No.
And I was delighted to see that they actually have someone called Ruff in the cast. That's amazing.
I know, right? That's commitment to a theme.
That is barking mad. All right. Well, that is it then for this week's Empire Podcast. Very, very exciting stuff indeed. This week's award-nominated Empire Podcast, by the way.
That's
I mentioned
right.
that earlier on. We should say we were
unverified
nominated.
Unverified awards.
Unverified awards. We've been nominated for the best podcast at the BSMEs, which is the British Society of Magazine Editors, and is the Oscars of the magazine industry. Hmm. I know I said that about the PPAs, but that's the Golden Globes of the magazine industry. So exciting. We're not going to win, but, you know, it's nice to be nominated, right?
It is.
Zero tucks given. Let's get our rags on for that one. Anyway, we should mention that we're going to be joined on next week's show. It's another cracking lineup of guests. We're going to be joined by the legendary Jim Broadbent and Penelope Wilton, stars of The Unlikely Pilgrimage of Harold Fry, and making a long-awaited return to the podcast, David Lowery, director of Peter Pan and Wendy, which debuts on Disney Plus next week. Can't say fairer than that, folks. Anyway, until we meet again, until then, until that auspicious occasion, it is time to say goodbye to my two colleagues of such lethal cunning. Do you have funny squad cast names this week?
No.
Simply just James.
Do.
Yeah, I know. I didn't even bother.
Oh.
Just phoning it in, literally.
Yes. M'lady de Helen.
Toodaloo.
Toodaloo. That's what she would say.
Milady de Helen, toodaloo.
Milady de Helen, toodaloo.
I forgot to talk about how great Eva Green is, but she's great. You know? Oh,
she's great in everything, isn't she?
I mean, she's great in everything, but like casting her as Milady, that is the most, yes, piece of casting in ages.
How was her wig?
Good. It's mostly hidden by some fantastic hats.
All right.
And a dress that actually made me gasp with admiration.
This is the truth. This is the truth. And Hollywood's been hiding this for years. Everyone in Hollywood is bald. Everybody. All of them. Filmmakers,
so.
Actors, actresses, key grips, best boys, all of them absolutely shiny and bald, and everybody wears a wig.
Except, ironically, Mark Strong.
Except
full head
Mark
hair.
Strong. Yeah, full head of hair. He just shaves it for roles as and when the mood takes him. It's goodbye from our very own wonderful baldy, James Dyer.
Goodbye. I'm going outside. This is actually doing this podcast remotely has made me feel like I'm in Missing, like this is some kind of screen life mystery. So I'm going to check and see if aliens have invaded.
And it is goodbye from me, Maximus Decimus Meridius, commander of the armies of the North, general of the Felix Legions, and loyal servant to the true emperor, Marcus Aurelius, father to a murdered son, husband to a murdered wife, employee of a murdered pope. And I will have my vengeance in this life or the next. Hewitt. Thank you so much for listening. I'm off to find the guy who makes Chris Evans' wig. And get one made for me. See you next time. Bye-bye. The Empire Podcast would like it to be known that Chris Evans does not wear a wig.